Blog Talk Radio.
I do whatever I can, wherever I am, whenever you want me to. Yeah, you have a friend in me till the end. Whatever I can, I'll do for you.
Welcome, everyone, to another great episode of Relationship Marketing 101 here on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Gina Gaudio-Graves, the Dean and Founder of the IAMUniversity.com, calling in to you live from Bonita Springs, Florida, as I do each week on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. And I have with me today my co-host, Jennifer Carter, from EmpoweringWomenInBusiness.com. And we have got a great guest for you today, right, Jennifer?
We have a fantastic guest, a guest that is wonderful in so many ways. I can't talk about them all here, but one of the things he's going to help people do is have massive, massive tax savings with their businesses and more. So, yes.
One of my favorite subjects, I'll tell you. I always hate the topic of how much money it costs us in taxes. So our guest today is Tom Wheelwright, the creative force behind Provision Wealth Strategist. For more than 25 years, Tom has developed innovative tax, business, and wealth strategies for sophisticated investors and business owners around the world, resulting in millions of dollars in profits. He's the founder of Provision Wealth, a published author with Rich Dad's Robert Kiyosaki, an adjunct professor, speaker with Robert Kiyosaki, Trump University, Harv Eker. Tom has hit this one goal: teach people how to create a strategic and proactive approach to wealth that creates lasting success. And I am all about strategic anything, so I can't wait for today. Tom's clients, on average, pay 40% less in taxes and learn to multiply their wealth in a fraction of the time it takes most people. Look, Tom's here today to teach you a new way to look at wealth. His strategies have helped thousands to unleash their wealth potential. Are you ready to unleash yours? Welcome, Tom.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here with you.
Well, I am so glad to have you. Although I'm an attorney, I can't honestly say I'm an expert at doing the tech strategies that so many of you are really great at. So I can't wait to pick your brain today about a few of them. I'm going to let Jennifer kind of take over from here and pop in between.
Well, thank you. I am, Tom, it's great to have you on the show. We appreciate you coming here today. One of the neat things about you, I'm going to have you tell a little bit more about yourself, how you got to where you are and where you're headed with your clients, with your company. It's a very interesting story. I've known you for some time now, maybe a year or two, and I've watched you do some really interesting and innovative things with large businesses, but small business owners as well. And today, we are going to be focusing on, the majority of our listeners are probably small business owners with some exceptions, internet marketers, of course, and I have watched you do amazing things I didn't know you could do to create not only massive tax savings, which is what we kind of said the bulk of this show is about today, but also some innovative wealth strategies that have turned people's businesses around 180 in amazing ways. So very excited about it. How in the world did you come to become a wealth strategist that helps people create massive tax savings? Let's start with that.
Well, you know, Jennifer, I started the way most people start out of college. I got my graduate degree and then went into a big company. And I was in big companies, both the big accounting firms as well as a Fortune 1000 company for years, for basically 12 or 13 years. And what I learned there was that there are a lot of great opportunities that the wealthy and the big companies understand in order to reduce their taxes, and they understand that the only way to increase your wealth substantially is to first reduce your taxes. And the reason for this is that if you think about it, you think about your dream, whatever your dream is. Most people I know dream of being wealthy. I don't know anybody who dreams of being poor. And they have this great dream, and they recognize that it's going to take some serious wealth to build their dream. And they also recognize that it's going to take some serious cash flow to build their wealth. What a lot of people forget to recognize is that the single biggest drain on their cash flow are taxes. The average business owner in the United States, and Canada for that matter, pays more than 50% of their income, 50% of their net income, in some kind of taxes, either income tax, sales tax, property tax, excise tax, payroll tax. That just taxes go on and on and on, and they're just a huge drain. So I realized when I was working for the big firms that the wealthy and the big companies were getting the advice that they could use to permanently reduce their taxes. And then, but my real passion, as you know, Jennifer, is the entrepreneur.
Right.
I've been an entrepreneur literally since I was 8 years old.
You have indeed. But you weren't paying taxes then. I said you weren't paying taxes then, or maybe you were.
No, I wasn't paying taxes when I was 8 year old.
Okay.
When in my first endeavor, where my buddy and I would take the marigolds, the dead marigolds, and pull the seeds out, put them in envelopes, and then sell them back to the owners, so they could plant them the next year. That was my first entrepreneurial experience, and I've always loved entrepreneurs. And so when I finally realized that I really had to get out of the big companies because it was just ripping my soul out, basically, then I decided that I needed to build an accounting firm that was dedicated to entrepreneurs and bringing this level of information, this knowledge, to the entrepreneur, the investor, the person who couldn't afford it, couldn't get it otherwise, and just wasn't getting it. All they were getting was ridiculous advice like maximize your IRA and your 401k, which is simply a matter of postponing taxes to a later year when you expect to be wealthy and pay a higher tax rate. So what we've done is we've continued to focus on the tax. What we've realized, though, is that over the years, is that taxes have such a big impact on wealth that we've learned so much about building wealth and the faster way to build wealth, not just through lower taxes, but through using leverage and velocity, two of the key terms we use in our company, ProVision. When we do that, boy, those dreams just get closer and closer and closer. So that's maybe a long way to say that we are just totally passionate about building wealth, building it fast, building it now, and reducing your taxes as part of that wealth-building strategy.
Okay. Now, this is something interesting. You say it's a part of your wealth-building strategy, and when I first met you, I knew that you were a wealth strategist, and you help people save money on taxes, and I thought, well, that's nice. We get to save a few percentages of what we're paying out in taxes. But the more I got to know you and watched you implement your strategies with your clients, with people, around the country and whatnot, this is what it brought me back to, and that is, and you say this and you teach this over and over again, that the wealthy, they follow different rules. They're legal rules, but they follow different rules, and they essentially are playing a different game, which is why they're wealthy as opposed to folks who are not. And what I know you're very good at is understanding that game of how to become wealthy and, more importantly, how to build up to that wealth and how to maintain that wealth. So from what I understand, there's some simple rules that people need to learn how to follow in order to start creating these massive tax savings, but then there's some strategy that's got to go along with it in order to build wealth, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, the reality is that the Internal Revenue Code, that's the tax law, okay, it's about 5,700 pages. It's growing daily, it seems like. That 5,700 pages, if you understand the rules and how it works, then you can understand that there are massive, massive amounts of tax savings within that 5,700 pages. Let me give you an example. Of the 5,700 pages, 30 pages approximately are devoted to raising taxes. That's it. 30 pages, it includes one line that says everything's taxable, and a bunch of tables that say, okay, here are the tax rates. Then there are 5,670 pages that are devoted to reducing taxes. So most of the tax law is actually devoted to reducing taxes. And of that 5,670 pages, only 400 are devoted to deferring taxes to a later year, things like 401ks and IRAs and pension plans and profit sharing plans. That leaves just under 5,300 pages of tax law that are devoted to permanently reducing your taxes. So the question is, why are so many people spending their time devoted to that 400 pages and ignoring the 5,300 pages? And I'll tell you my own personal guess at this. First of all, it's easy. It's easy to defer taxes. It doesn't take really any effort on either your accountant's part or on your part. All you have to do is put money into your IRA or your 401k. It takes care of it. If you understand the rest of the rules, which is what the wealthy understand, now you can permanently reduce your taxes. So instead of just postponing them like most people do, in fact, I've done a little studying, and I estimate that about 95% of tax planning in the U.S. is deferring taxes. In other words, just postponing them to a later year when you're going to be in a higher tax bracket. Instead, if you could permanently reduce your taxes, just think of how powerful that would be.
And you're just talking about, you're saying our IRAs, our 401ks is nothing, for the most part, is nothing but tax deferral. That's really what that spread is.
That's all it is. Unless it's a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k, that's permanent, and certainly we prefer that over the other. There are even some limitations on the Roth IRA and 401k that I'm not overly thrilled about. Certainly better than just postponing taxes to a later year.
Okay. Well, now, you said something earlier about hundreds and thousands of, I didn't write down all the numbers, Tom, but tons and tons of tax codes written for, a little bit written for tax deferral, but most of it for tax savings. But I know why I, not a tax planner or a tax lawyer, and you know, a lot of my fellow entrepreneurs don't know a lot about taxes because it's one, it's confusing. There's so much out there. And two, I'll just speak for myself, and I know some people who are still, you know, they postponed, they did the little delay thing on their taxes, and they're still working through all their books because they had so much stuff. They just want to get it out of the way because it's so darn confusing. It's a big knot in the stomach. You just want, fine, pay it, here, take my little deductions, whatever, and move forward because it's confusing. And therefore, I've learned through you, people burn through thousands, tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars unnecessarily just by not understanding a few rules. What I'd love to do is, I'd love for you to give us a couple of examples. You've helped some people put in a couple of simple changes in their business or just a simple way of structuring or something whereby you saved a few thousand, tens of thousands, even more. And the reason I want you to come up with an example here is because it's not just about saving a few thousand dollars. It's about saving that money and then turning around and building the wealth, and it's not as complicated as people may believe it is. So what are some examples, Tom, of things you've done to help people start building that wealth and saving money for taxes?
Well, let me give you a real simple principle, and I'll follow it with an example. If you look at your typical taxpayer earns their income. They pay their taxes through withholding or estimated payments if you're a business owner, and then they pay their expenses, and what's left over is their cash flow. Now, the ideal taxpayer understands that you can earn your income and then pay your expenses before you pay your taxes, which it gives you a lot more cash flow so that you can build your wealth faster. So all we're doing here, this is one of the rules that the wealthy understands, is that if we can shift our expenses from non-deductible to deductible, or when we shift our expenses from non-deductible to deductible, now all of a sudden we've created a permanent tax benefit. And let me give you an example of how you might shift a deduction from non-deductible to deductible. I have a client, his name's John, and John lives here in the Phoenix area where I live. And John came to me a couple of years ago, and he wanted to learn all about the how to reduce his taxes. He'd heard about us and was just feeling the pain about the taxes, his taxes. And we're going through this, and I'm giving him, you know, all going through building a strategy, and we're he hears that, gee, about this idea of creating deductions from his expenses. And he says, well, Tom, so I like to travel to New Mexico. I love to go to New Mexico. It's beautiful over there. I go several times a year. Is there a way to make that deductible? I said, sure. So I went through the rules for making it deductible. Now, here's something for all of our listeners to understand about the tax law, and this is how to think about the tax law. If you can show that your expense has a business purpose to it, and it's ordinary and necessary to your business, then you get to deduct it. So what John needed to do was he needed to find a business purpose for his travel to New Mexico. Well, John likes real estate, so John decided that he would go, when he went to New Mexico, he would look at real estate, he'd really get into it, and John did everything right. Now, John, he absolutely was going to dot all his I's and cross his T's. All that documentation he needed, he was going to, that I explained to him, he was going to go through, and he was going to spend the time that he needed to spend. By doing that, he was going to be able to deduct his travel. So about a month later, John comes back. He's very excited. Can hardly contain himself. He says, Tom, I went to New Mexico. It was great. He says, I did everything you said. Do I get to deduct my travel expenses? I said, absolutely. You won't have any problem. And I asked him, I said, how much will this save you on an annual basis? He said, it'll save me $3,000 to $4,000 in taxes. I said, well, that's pretty cool. He says, oh, yeah. I mean, I can do some good things with that $3,000 or $4,000. And I sensed that John was a little more excited than just $3,000 or $4,000, which was not bad. He was a little more excited than that. I said, John, I said, what's going on here? What is it that is getting you so excited about $3,000 to $4,000 in taxes? John said, well, it's not just the tax savings, Tom. I found a deal. I found a real estate deal. I said, really? He says, yeah. He says, it will net me about $1 million. Okay? So I'm thinking about this after our conversation. I'm going, now, here's what's really happened. Now, when John actually does that development deal, he'll make $1 million, and even with our great tax planning, he'll probably pay $300,000 in taxes. So what's the government telling us? They're telling us that they're happy to give up the $3,000 now in order to get the $300,000 later. They're totally good with that. So this is the thought. This is just one of the thought processes behind the Internal Revenue Code, behind the tax laws. As you begin to understand the thought process of the law, you don't have to know all the details. You do have to understand the thought process, because even as your tax advisor, even if I'm your personal tax advisor, I can't be with you all the time. So you have to learn some of the fundamental thought processes behind the Internal Revenue Code, behind the tax law. And when you do that, then you can start applying it to multiple situations. So now do you think, now we only talked, John and I only talked about this trip, these trips to New Mexico. What if he travels somewhere else? Do you think John now might have an idea of what he needs to do to get his other travel and
meals? I bet he's looking for lots of real estate deals, lots of real estate investment deals.
Exactly, and look at all the money he's going to make actually doing those deals. So the tax law actually incentivizes us. It actually provides an incentive for us to improve the economy. It provides incentive for us to do better business. And so I think the tax law is actually good. I think there are a lot of good things in the tax law, because they're providing good incentives to do the right thing to improve the economy, improve our wealth, and improve a lot of other things about our country.
And by, so you're saying it's set up for us to do well in business. And I know when you first start as a small business owner, depending on how people set themselves up, you know, sole proprietor, or whether they're setting up corporate structures, and hopefully they are, and I don't know if you can, maybe you can address that just a little bit, But anyways, as we first get started, as you said earlier, my gosh, there's so many taxes taken out, and it is it's kind of a scary prospect. It can seem that the government does not want you to succeed in business. And I know that's a big, ugly statement, but, you know, we're watching all of these things going on with the new tax codes and maybe new tax laws to be putting in place, and it kind of makes you go, oh, my gosh, it's tough enough as it is. But you're saying that if we understand the rules, it really is set up, and it is incentivized, if that's a word, for us to succeed, for us to do better in business, so long as
it really is. Let me take your example, Jennifer. Let's look at this example of the sole proprietor.
Okay.
The sole proprietor, here's what happens with a typical sole proprietor. They have no corporate entity. They're not a limited liability company. They're not a corporation. They're just on their own. Okay. And they have, because of this, they tend to have poor accounting, because the IRS, as a sole proprietor, you're not required to have the balance sheets and all of the other full accounting records. So what you do is you report on your Schedule C. Well, what are the impacts of being a sole proprietor? First of all, many of you know that when you're a sole proprietor, you have a lot more liability. In fact, you have unlimited liability for all of the actions of not just you, but all of your employees and anything else that goes on in your business. So you're not protecting your business. So it's not good business from that standpoint. Second of all, you're paying a lot more tax. You're paying, for example, you're paying self-employment tax on 100% of your net income. There are other benefits that you can't get in a sole proprietorship, tax benefits. Why is that? Well, and in fact, there's one other thing. You know, as a sole proprietor, you're four times more likely to be audited than if you're not a sole proprietor. Well, why is that? The reason is that being a sole proprietor is just not a good business practice. So if you now instead have that corporate entity and protect yourself from liability, okay, that's a good thing. If you have full accounting and record keeping, which is required if you're an LLC taxes a partnership, or you're an LLC taxes a corporation, or you're a corporation or an S corporation, if you're one of these, then you have to maintain full accounting. Well, full accounting is good business, and the IRS likes full accounting. That's why they don't. That's one of the reasons they don't audit corporations and limited partnerships more as much as they do sole proprietorships, because corporations and limited partnerships are more likely to have good accounting, and so they know that there's more likely that you're actually running a legitimate business instead of maybe just a hobby, which is what a lot of people, you know, treat their hobbies as a sole proprietorship on their Schedule C. So there's a lot of good business reasons to not be a sole proprietor. Congress basically has put that into the Internal Revenue Code and say, look, it's bad business to be a sole proprietor, so we're going to penalize you for being a sole proprietor. If you do good business, we're going to reward you for doing good business.
Well, now, you said sole proprietorship, it's easy to set up because you don't set up anything. You just say, hey, I'm a sole proprietor. And,
exactly.
You know, you can have a business license, but you don't even necessarily have to, depending on what business you're in. So you're right. A lot of people, I think, start out that way. I believe, and especially since, you know, we have a lot of Internet-based marketers on the phone here who are listening to the show today who, you know, their businesses are run out of their home, and maybe they travel now and then. But it makes sense, I believe, to them to start out as a sole proprietor until they reach a certain level of success in their business. And then they'll look into setting up some kind of corporate structure, because corporate structure is just for big guys who are making, you know, $500,000 a year and above, right?
Absolutely not. What a horrible mistake.
Okay,
first
well,
of all,
when should somebody start thinking about corporate structure and whatnot?
You know, Jennifer, that's one of the single most common questions I get, whether I'm teaching at a seminar, no matter where I am. That's one of the questions I get over and over and over again. When do I start? My question back to you would be, when do you want to start protecting your assets and saving taxes? When do you want to start when do you want to start doing business the best way? When do you want to start having your foundation and your fundamentals all set up right for your business? Well, hopefully you want to do that before you even start your business, right? You don't want to wait. If let's say you wait until you make that first $500,000. Well, look at how much additional tax you might be paying on that $500,000 that you didn't have to pay if you set up early. Now, internet marketers especially are particularly suspect for this because you can make your internet marketing business can take off in at any time. It can be so it can just all of a sudden, you know, one day you've got three customers and the next day you have 3,000 customers. I know that. I've seen that with a number of internet marketers. The faucet, the spigot just turns right on and all of a sudden they're making all this money. They don't know what to do. And you know, they're not used to doing all the tax planning, and all of a sudden they're caught because you can't go backwards. You can only go forwards with tax planning.
You brought up an interesting thing about protecting yourself from liability, not only for your actions, but those of other people. And I think most people don't think that's going to be a big deal until they get bigger in business. But what's interesting is Gina just finished this big event last week, just this past weekend, in fact, about how to put together joint ventures. And she's the joint venture queen is kind of her tag name out there. And really, she's put together some incredibly large joint ventures with other people and, of course, with herself, and that's what she was showing people. And one of the things that she brought up is, hey, you have to be careful how you put these things together because if and when one of your partners, your joint venture partners, doesn't do something correctly or ethically or even just they make a big dumb mistake, you're liable as well as them for correcting the mistake, and it can cost lots of money and actually put somebody out of business. But I imagine if they're at least structured correctly, then there's some levels of protection from mistakes that partners.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing this up, Jennifer, because the only thing worse than being a sole proprietor is being a general partnership. Because think of it this way: as a sole proprietor, it's like you're standing out in a field and you're naked, and you have no protection against the elements, and people can be throwing rocks at you, and you're having to dodge the rocks constantly. Because you're totally exposed. With a partnership, which is what a joint venture is, by the way, if you don't have any other agreement, it's a partnership. If you're sharing net profits, it's a partnership. Okay? So, and sometimes even when you're sharing gross profits. So you have to be really careful. If you're a partnership, it's just like you're standing out there naked in the field, and your partner, your joint venture partner, is standing out there with you, and any rocks that are thrown at him can also hit you, and guess what? Someday, he may pick up a rock and throw it at you. So you're totally exposed. This is a great point, Jennifer. I'm really glad you brought this up. Internet marketers do a lot of joint ventures.
And they don't really understand that that's what they're doing. It just, one of these days, I know somebody is going to get sued, one internet marketer. And they're going to be crying big time when it happens because they don't really know what they're doing. They're using the term in a marketing speak kind of way, not recognizing that they have clear legal implications of doing so. And the things that internet marketers call joint ventures are truly affiliate marketing. I can't imagine any internet marketer doing a joint venture that's a product launch really intending for their JV partners to become partners in what they're doing. And yet that's what they're really setting themselves up for.
No, you're totally right. So you have both the legal aspects you're talking about. You also have some potential tax aspects here that could be just horrible for you as far as setting that up. So Jennifer, you just bring up a great point that you have to be so careful making sure that your deals are structured properly.
How do you recommend setting them up? Because joint ventures is something I talk about quite often.
Well, it really depends on, here's the answer to every tax question. It depends.
Yeah, that's what I figured you were going to say.
It really depends on what you're setting up. If it's purely, if it's really truly a pure affiliate situation, okay, you may not, you should not be a partnership if you're a if it's a true affiliate. In other words, if somebody's just selling your product, okay, now they might have, of course, anybody, when you sell somebody else's products, are you going to potentially be liable for those products? I think you have some potential liability. So certainly, whatever entity, whatever you're using to join in with that joint venture partner or anything you use, any entity that you're selling from into with an affiliate, you want to make sure that that entity is protected. So take the sole proprietor. You're a sole proprietor, and you're selling somebody else's products, and something happens with those products, and that product fails or something like that. Now, you're the attorney. I'm not. Seems to me like you've got some exposure here if you're a sole proprietor, whereas let's say you're a limited liability company or a corporation, now you've at least protected your other assets, your other wealth, if you get that lawsuit.
Right. I would suggest doing that at a bare bones minimum.
Exactly. And then, of course, there are, you know, depending on who you're doing it with and how complex the structure, you can do all sorts of things to protect yourself.
Okay, well, Tom, let's say we've set up our structure, but I want to ask this because I know other people are thinking it. Well, I'm a sole proprietor because it's too complicated to set up a corporate structure. I mean, that just has a big imposing sounding name, corporate structure. I think IBM. How difficult is it to get yourself set up properly so that you're not paying 100% on your self-employment taxes and you're exposed to all of this liability? How difficult is it to set up corporate structure?
You know, it's really very simple. Certainly, setting up a limited liability company or a corporation, typically you can most states you can do it online. It's that simple. If you have, you know, if there's more than one of you, you probably want to use an attorney. Certainly, if it's not just you who's doing it, if you have other partners or other members of your company.
And heck, you can even find those online easily.
Exactly. So it's really simple that way. As far as actually putting together your strategy, now that gets into what is a strategy, and a simple definition of a strategy is a systematic plan of action to accomplish a specific purpose. So in our case, what we want to accomplish is we want to reduce our exposure. We call that asset protection, and we want to reduce our taxes. So what we need to do is we need to look at what are the components of that strategy. Let me just give you a few of the components of a good strategy, including a good tax strategy. Now, we would have these same components in a wealth strategy or a business strategy as well. So people can, most of us have a business strategy or a marketing strategy, so you can kind of relate this to your marketing strategy, for example. So you always have to start with, where are you today? Most people, unfortunately, don't even know where they are today. They don't know what their tax situation is today. So that's the very first step, is to figure out, sit down with your tax advisor and figure out exactly where you are today. How are you structured? Because you may not even know. You know, you may not know, like we were discussing earlier, you may not know that you're a partnership. Are you a partnership? So sit down and make sure that you know where you are today. Then make sure that you're focused on the long term. And when it comes to tax planning, the long term typically includes beyond your lifetime. The reason is that we have estate taxes in the United States and Canada, and we have other issues that we want to deal with prior to, you know, while we're alive, right? So we want to make sure that we're looking at the very long term. Next, we want to make sure that we're looking at the big picture. When we're looking at tax strategy, one of the things I run into all the time, you know, I was just saying that my answer to all tax questions, actually the best answer to any tax question that you can ask a CPA is, it depends. And the reason is because you have to look at your entire picture. You need to look at your family situation, your business situation, what your other investments are. You need to look at your personal situation, because the last thing you want to do is do something that might save you taxes that causes you major business problems or major personal problems. I've actually seen, I actually had a client a few years ago who had done some, what turned out to be, was great tax planning with his attorney. It was very poor family planning. In fact, it was, it's maybe a little tough to make this connection, but it was such poor family planning, it contributed to the divorce of one of his daughters.
Oh, my goodness.
Family planning actually contributed to the divorce of one of his daughters. So we have to look at the whole picture and can't just look at the tax consequences, and we have to look at it long term, because when they did that tax planning, the daughter wasn't married. That tax planning was done when the daughter was 10 or 11 years old. The daughter ends up getting married, and it ends up actually being a serious issue between the daughter and her husband. They end up getting a divorce in large part, actually, over that tax structure. So that's the third thing. And then the last thing is we need to make sure that our strategy is flexible, because the one thing we all know is that tomorrow will be different than today, and our lives are going to change, and our business is going to change. You're small now, you may be bigger later, so you need to allow for that expansion. You may be big now, and you may decide that you're going to contract later on purpose or because of the economy or something else. You need to look at that. Also, most internet marketers are selling multiple products and constantly coming up with new products, so we need to look at, what are we going to do with the new products? Or we leave them in the same entity. Entity, by the way, is just how you own your asset. Okay? Are we going to leave that intellectual property, which is, you know, your trademarks and your trade secrets, and if you're doing a health supplement, it's your product formula. You know, those things, we need to protect those as well. So I know it sounds like it's a little complicated. You know, we can actually, for most internet marketers, for example, for most internet marketers, it takes us 2 phone calls, a total of about an hour and a half, to put this whole thing together. That's all it takes. It's really that simple once we have all of the information. Once we have all the information, we actually spend, of that an hour and a half, most of the time is spent asking questions. And if you don't mind, I'll give you just one little tip on good advisors. The way to choose a good advisor and know that an advisor is a good advisor is by the questions they ask you. Because what they need to be doing is discovering what you need, what you want, and most of the time you have the answers. Even when it comes to tax issues, because the tax law is very much, the tax consequences are very much determined by the facts and circumstances of the taxpayer. So if your facts and circumstances are different than somebody else's facts and circumstances, then the same law will apply differently to you than it does to the other person, even between internet marketers. So it's very important that you have that sit down with a tax advisor that will ask you the right questions and will spend the time actually explaining it, and so that you actually understand and are educated on not all the rules. You don't need to know all the details. You have to know the thought process behind the rules and some of the basic rules so that on a day-to-day basis you can function to reduce your taxes, which of course increases your cash flow, increases your wealth, and brings your dream closer into you.
Now, Tom, is tax, some of the tax strategies, is it really just a matter of figuring out, okay, what can I deduct? How can I make this a business expense so I can just deduct it? Is that what it's about, or is there more to it than that?
Oh,
a lot more to it than that, isn't it?
We're just scratching the surface. We're just scratching the surface. Let me give you another example. Let's say you're doing well and you're in internet marketing and you're in a 30% tax bracket. How would you like to take some of that income and put it into a 15% tax bracket?
Of course, I'd like to make.
Wouldn't that be great?
15%, yeah.
Okay, and that can be permanent. So if you can take, you've actually cut your taxes in half by going from a 30% tax bracket to a 15% tax bracket. So reducing tax brackets is another type of permanent difference. Another is changing the type of income. For example, ordinary income is taxed at the highest rate, whereas capital gains and dividends are taxed at 15% right now. So shifting income either to a different type of income or to a lower bracket can be huge. So it's not just deductions. There are a lot of other things. There are tax credits. Tax credits are like, I had somebody this weekend. I was at a conference, and I had somebody say that they were going to, they wanted to be uber wealthy, uber rich, like really, really rich. And a tax credit is like an uber deduction. It's like really, really good, because a tax credit is actually dollar for dollar off your taxes. Okay, it's like this the new home buying credit right now. There's an $8,000 credit that's refundable. That means that a new home buyer, basically with an FHA loan, can buy a house with no money down and actually get money back from the government in excess of the money they put down. The government is actually paying new home buyers right now to buy houses.
Really?
Yes. So that's, wouldn't you like to know that kind of information? I mean, isn't that information?
Well, yeah, especially for somebody like me who doesn't own a house.
There you go. Now, it has to be a first-time home buyer. You've never bought a house before, and there are a lot of people. There are millions of people who've never bought a house before. Boy, and the prices of houses right now are so low, and the financing is so low. If you don't own a home and you have any kind of decent credit, you know, your credit rating is somewhere over 650, then you should be buying a house because it's free. The government is giving them away.
So there's a lot of these kinds of tax credits out there. I mean, we're talking about, well, I was about to say children and child care, but those are deductions. Give us some examples of some other tax credits.
Well, there is a child care credit. Okay, that's a credit. Okay, that's a great credit, 20% of what you pay for child care. That's a credit. That's a good one. There are several different... I'll give you a great one. If you're thinking about investing in real estate and you invest in a historical project, there's a credit for that. There are low-income housing credits that are gigantic. Of course, if you're making very little or very little money, there's the earned income credit, which is another refundable credit. So the difference between, by the way, just to clarify, there are two different types of credits. There's a refundable credit and a non-refundable credit. A refundable credit, you get the money whether or not you pay any tax. Okay? And yeah, you heard me right. You get the money even if you didn't pay any tax. So it's really a stipend from the government. So take this $8,000 first-time homebuyer's credit. Let's say that you only owe $1,000 of tax in total, because you know you're starting your internet business. You don't have a lot of income to show right now after your deductions, because you've maximized your deductions, and so you only pay $1,000 of income tax for the entire year. Well, the government's going to send you a check. Okay, you owe $1,000. They're going to send you a check for $7,000, the $8,000 credit minus the $1,000 that you owe. Even though, so you get, that's a refundable credit. Earned income credit is a refundable credit. A non-refundable credit is one where if you didn't pay any tax, you don't get the money. So in our situation where you let's say you owed $1,000 and you had a $3,000 credit, you'd get $1,000 of the benefit right now. The other $2,000 you wouldn't get now, and you might not ever get. I'll tell you another one, adoption credit. There's a great adoption credit for adopting children, which I wished I'd had when I adopted my son. Didn't have that credit. Very expensive to adopt a child. So we have, this is, again, think about why they're doing this. This is social engineering, basically. They're encouraging you to have child care. They're encouraging you, they're basically, Even the basic child credit, okay, that's to help out families with you know, with children, with young children to give them something back to help them deal with those children and pay for the children.
Okay, so those are some of the credits. Tom, what about for people who are just getting started, aren't really familiar with business tax laws, business tax rules, and structuring? What are examples of some of the kinds of deductions that people may be eligible for in their business?
Let me give you some of the big ones. We talked
marketing.
About travel.
Okay.
Meals and entertainment is a big one. I see a lot of business owners who know how to deduct all the meals and entertainment and how to make those deductible. Another one is home office deduction. Home office deduction, there's a lot of bad information out in the tax world, and a lot of people here, I get this all the time. I'm looking at people's tax returns every week because we have so many people wanting our services, and I'm looking at their tax returns, and I see that they haven't taken home office deduction, even though they're entitled. I said, why didn't you take home office deduction? And actually, 100 times out of 100 times, the answer is, my accountant told me that it was a red flag and it wasn't worth that much anyway. And I'm going,
say what?
What? Are you kidding me? First of all, it's a deduction. It's allowed in the Internal Revenue Code, so it's not a red flag. Okay, now I will admit, 15 years ago, it probably raised a bit, it probably got the IRS's attention. These days, there are so many home-based businesses, I don't think it gets the IRS's attention at all, any more than any other deduction. So home office deduction is a big one. Another one, your car, taking the right car expense, for your business, determining how much you can take and maximizing the amount of the deduction you can take for your car. It's a huge one. There are some, I could just go on and on and on. Again, let's go back to the thought process. Anything that you spend potentially is deductible. Any amount of money you spend is potentially deductible. All we have to do is show that it had a business purpose to it and that it was an ordinary and necessary expense in order for us to conduct our business. Ordinary simply meaning that it's typical that a business owner in this type of business might have this expense. And it's necessary, meaning that it's actually going to help the business. It's either going to produce income or reduce some other cost. So having that thought process behind it, now you can start thinking about, okay, now, wow, what can I do? What kind of expenses can I look at that, if I sit down with my tax advisor, they can show me a little more detailed rules about how I can make those deductible. Any expense potentially is deductible.
So for internet marketers, we're potentially saying that things like everything from software to hosting services to web design to education on how to grow your business, all of those things are potentially deductible because if they're helping your business.
Right. To cell phone service, to internet service, all of these are potentially deductible as business expenses as long as they are... They have the true business purpose, they meet the rules, and we do the proper documentation.
Okay, great. So we're doing all of our deductions. Now I know somewhere along the way, and in fact you mentioned this earlier, that there's different kinds of income out there. Man, I know when I got my first job, I thought, well, I have a salary, here's the taxes they take out, and income is income. But that's not true. You say that there are different types of income, and there are in fact preferred types of income. Tell us a little bit about what you mean of different kinds of income and what would be a preferred kind. I think the preferred kind is me keeping more money, but tell us what you mean by it.
Well, that's what I think, too.
Preferred
income is any income that's mine. That's the way I look at it. Any income I get to keep, that's preferred. I always prefer income I get to keep to income I don't get to keep. So in the internal revenue, in the tax laws, what's preferred? Well, there are actually three different buckets of income in the tax law. There's ordinary income, there's investment income, and there's passive income. Okay? Now, of those three, the best kind of income is passive income. All right? The worst kind of income is ordinary income. And even worse than ordinary income is ordinary income that you earn as a sole proprietor or in a general partnership, because on that, you're not only paying income tax at the highest rate, you're also paying self-employment taxes, Social Security taxes at the highest rate. So that's self-employed income, worst kind of income by far. Ordinary income means any regular income that you earn, salary, business income, typically ordinary income, that's ordinary income. Investment income, that's things like capital gains, right? Capital gains, long-term capital gains. If you have a capital gain, that's when you sell something that you've owned for investment purposes, like a stock or a piece of real estate, and you've held it for at least a year and a day, and you sell that, that's long-term capital gain, and that's taxed at 15%. So that's great income. And then we have passive income, which is income like income from rentals, income from businesses that we don't actually spend a lot of time in. That kind of income is absolutely the best, because that income, typically, we can make passive income non-taxable completely. Passive income can be completely non-taxable. Okay, so those are kind of your three basic types of income.
From an internet marketing where one of our goals is to create passive income, right? We set up deals, we get marketing machines rolling and in place, and from an internet marketer's perspective, passive income is, you know, something where, I put it in place, I don't have to do any more marketing, and it just, you know, that the ads roll out and the income rolls in, or the partners keep selling. My affiliate partners, for example, keep selling for me. Is that considered passive income, or is that going to go back over to ordinary income?
You know what? If it's structured right, that can absolutely be passive income. If it's set up right, that can be passive income, and you can have that income be non-taxable if you've done your wealth strategy properly and done all of your tax planning. That can actually become non-taxable income.
I think I'd like to learn how to make that income passive income in the IRS from the IRS standpoint.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
That'd be super cool. Okay. So what else about the tax savings? What else do people in business need to keep in mind to start creating these massive tax savings?
Oh, man, there's just so much. You know, another thing we have to look at, of course, is I'll get back to the tax savings in a minute. We also ought to look at how do we reduce our chances of an IRS audit. Jennifer, you're a speaker. I'm a speaker, and we've heard this old saying that these statistics that the only thing that people are more afraid of than death is public speaking.
Yeah.
Well, I happen to think there's one thing that people are more afraid of than public speaking, and that's an IRS audit.
Yeah, That idea sounds pretty scary. That's true. That's why, you know, we're going out and filling out, doing our taxes. Absolutely. You know, go double check this and that, and are you sure we can take... Yeah. Yeah, the idea is scary. I've seen the movies.
So there are lots of things we can do to reduce an IRS audit. We talked about one earlier. We talked about that a sole proprietor filing a Schedule C is four times more likely to be audited than somebody who's not a sole proprietor filing a Schedule C. So that's one thing we can do right there to reduce our risk of an IRS audit. Now, I was talking to my staff the other day in our training meeting, and I asked them, I said, you know, come up, just write down all the things we do when we prepare a tax return, a provision, to either reduce the risk of an audit or reduce taxes. This is just preparing the tax return. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, we're going to come up with five or six or seven items. You know, this is that would be good. They came up with 79 different ways, 79 different specific things that we do when we prepare a tax return to either reduce the risk of audit or to reduce taxes. And the reason we can do that is that people think that the tax forms, filling out tax forms, that there's only one right way to do it. That's not at all true. There are an infinite number of right ways to do it. Okay, the IRS actually gives us lots of leeway in how we report things on our tax return. So when we prepare those tax returns, this is why, you know, people think of a tax return, well, anybody can prepare an accurate tax return. Well, not anybody can prepare an accurate tax return. Beyond that, it's more important, it's not just preparing an accurate tax return. It's preparing a tax return that reduces our audit risk and reduces our taxes, because there's so many little things we can do that where we report a deduction, for example. How do we show it? Where do we report income? How do we show that? Okay, sometimes there are choices on what we can do. And it doesn't only reduce our audit risk, also reduces our taxes. So how you prepare your tax return, who your tax preparer is actually a critical part of your tax planning. We actually look at tax returns as the last piece of tax planning. It's the implementation of our tax planning for last year, and it's the beginning of our tax planning for next year. So very important how you think about a tax return. So that's another way that you can reduce your taxes, is to find a tax preparer who really understands the law, how the IRS works, how the law works, and can actually do things on your tax return to reduce your taxes. Let me give you another example here. Here's a tax that people don't think about, and internet marketers especially, and there's some real opportunities to reduce taxes, and that is state income taxes. Now, when you're an internet marketer, you're not just paying federal income tax, you're paying state income tax. And you have two different types of taxes that you're required to pay. One is income tax, the other is sales tax. So income tax, there are a number of ways to reduce your state income taxes. Now, I get a little passionate about this, I warn you. I get a little passionate about this. This is what I've been teaching as an adjunct professor at Arizona State University for the past 14 years. I teach in the Masters of Tax program, and I teach about multi-state income tax and sales tax and property tax. So we have the income tax, and there's lots of things we can do, and internet marketers especially can do phenomenal things to actually have. I've seen internet marketers who were able to have less than half of their income subject to tax in state taxes. Others that actually have been able to eliminate their income tax, their state income tax entirely. Then from a sales tax, I almost think, in fact, in ways, sales tax is even more important. And this is a big one for internet marketers. And we don't typically think about sales tax a lot, except that, okay, we have to collect it. Where do we collect it? In what states where we have customers, because if you're an internet marketer, you have customers in all 50 states, hopefully. So in what states do you have to collect tax? And what happens if you don't collect the tax? Let's start with that. Let's start with what happens if you don't collect sales tax. Well, let's say that you don't collect sales tax in the state of Washington. Okay, state of Washington has a humongous sales tax because they have no income tax. So let's say that you don't collect sales tax in Washington. What happens? Well, let's say 6 years down the road, you've been selling into Washington, you haven't been collecting tax, and technically you're required to collect tax, you just haven't done it. Well, you've got 6 years of sales tax. Let's say the state of Washington comes back to you and say, you should have been paying this tax. Now, I'm a little sensitive to this because I've seen clients with this specific issue, specifically Washington. They're very aggressive. They come back to you and they say, you should have been collecting tax for the last 6 years. Okay, so you go, okay, well, I'll just pass that on to my customers, right? Of course not.
Likely, yeah.
Not likely.
Yeah.
You know, 6 years later, you're going to go back to your customer and say, oh, by the way, you owe me sales tax? Are you kidding me?
Now,
it's not
this is
happen.
For
so,
my clients who live in Washington, right? Or, well, this is where I get
not just,
all the
that's
time.
The key. Thank you for bringing that up, Jennifer. It's not just for people, for your customers it's for your customers who live in Washington. It's not just for internet marketers who live in Washington. It could be all of your customers that live in Washington. You may think you don't have a sales tax collection responsibility, and in fact you do. So what happens to that sales tax that you pay? It ends up going straight to your bottom line. So this is one of the biggest compliance issues that there is for internet marketers, because if you know where to charge tax, then you can collect the tax. Nobody minds paying sales tax, really. They understand. It's just, you just pay sales tax. You know, it's just automatically added in. That's what happens. So you collect the sales tax, you pay it. What's your cost? Well, it's the cost of preparing the sales tax report. That's it. Whereas if you don't collect the tax and you get audited and you have to pay the tax, I've literally seen companies go out of business because of sales tax audits. Literally, they can go out of business. Let me share one other little piece of information on this. Let's say that you file that tax report, that sales tax report, and you made a mistake and you didn't collect enough sales tax. Well, 3, 4, 5 years down, let's say that 6 years down the road, they come after you. Well, guess what? They can't collect any more tax for 6 years before, because there's what's called a statute of limitations, which means that they can only come after you for a few years. You know, 3 or 4 years typically, they can come after you. After that, they can't come after you at all. If you don't file the report, they can come after you forever. If you don't file the report, they can come after you forever. So this is why we recommend, particularly with internet marketers, that you have a seasoned multi-state sales tax expert review your marketing and review what you're doing. And it can cost anywhere from $1,000, and you know, if it's complex, it could cost several thousand dollars. It will save you hundreds of thousands of dollars. So the cost is just minimal compared to the savings for just doing a little sales tax study, just looking at your operations, looking at what you're doing, and determining, okay, these states you need to collect sales tax in. The states, just understand, the states are getting a lot more aggressive on both income tax and sales tax, as you would expect in a down economy. They're looking for money, and so they're going after taxpayers that previously they've never gone after. Huge issue.
Tom, if I don't know a whole lot about tax law and rules, et cetera, how in the world am I going to find a tax expert? How in the world can I figure out whether or not somebody is, in fact, a seasoned multi-state tax expert, and whether or not if they know these rules or not? How do we find somebody who's good and who can really help us out with that?
Well, I give you a couple of general suggestions, and then I'll give you a very specific suggestion. General rule, first of all, I mentioned before, the best tax advisors are those who ask you a lot of good questions. So once you have somebody that's been referred to you, you can sit down with them, see what kind of questions they ask, make sure the questions are really about you, not about them, and make sure that they are really, that you get a feeling pretty quick about their level of knowledge of the tax law. Second of all, there aren't a lot of people who understand the multi-state laws. There really aren't. Unfortunately, there are very few professionals. When you get out of the big four accounting firms, there are very few accounting firms that specialize in multi-state taxes. For example, and here's your specific my specific little recommendation here. In Arizona, the only firm I know of that specializes in multi-state is Provision, my firm. And the reason we do is this is my little passion, my little expertise that I bring to the firm, and so we have this expertise. The good news is we can work all over the world. We have clients in every state in the country and many, many countries outside of the U.S. And this is particularly important for those who are internet marketers who are not residents of the U.S. and are doing business in the U.S. They also have exposure. So the general idea is find somebody who will ask good questions, who seems to know something and really has a true specialty in multi-state. Get a good referral from your CPA, because it's probably not your CPA. Probably not your CPA. We do work for other CPAs, for their clients, who have particularly sales tax issues and multi-state issues. Certainly, we're happy to talk to anybody at Provision absolutely happy at provisionwealth.com. You can go in and find our contact info, which I'm sure you'll give people at the end of the show. You can certainly find our contact information. We're happy to talk to any of your listeners and help them any way we can.
Fantastic. Because I think probably everybody who's doing business, who's an internet marketer, is doing business in multi-state, and I don't think that's something that is commonly understood or thought about. So that's actually a small but I think important point that you've brought up. Okay, so need to know our multi-state taxes. We've got to know what kind of income we have and try and put as much of our income in the preferred tax, the preferred kind of income as possible. And you're pretty good at figuring out where the passive income is, or how to I guess structure or understand which rules in order to make more income passive. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but
well, that's right, and this kind of goes to, and I may have skirted this question you'd asked earlier, and other things we can do from a tax planning standpoint. When we start doing a tax strategy, the very first thing we do after gathering the information is we look at the different entities. An entity, like I said, is just the way you own your assets. And as an internet marketer, you actually have multiple assets. You have intellectual property, probably. If you're marketing your own products or your own services, you have intellectual property. This is the ideas. You know what generated the product. It could be the trademarks, the copyrights, the patents, any of those things. Those are intellectual property. That's one type of asset. Another type of asset is the actual operations of the business, and we like to separate these two because the operations are where you're likely to have liability. In other words, somebody may sue you over something you did operationally, like in your sales or marketing, whereas your intellectual property, you'd like to protect that. So we need to look at your different assets and how are they owned right now versus how should they be owned. What's the best way from a tax standpoint to own them? Because those entities, whether they're corporations or LLCs, whatever they are, those entities are so fundamental. They're kind of the building blocks to your tax strategy. And so if you want to, and in fact, how you own, so your entities, getting back to your question, Jennifer, about passive income, how we make that passive is going to be severely affected, largely affected by the type of entity that handles that part of your business. Okay, so the part of your business that you're spending all the time in, okay, that's, you're spending a lot of time in your business, that's not passive by definition, right? You set it up so that you've got all these passive streams because all you've done is set up your ad on your website, or you set up a landing page or something like that, and you've got all of these people buying through and you're really not doing anything, they're just clicking through, then you know what? That may be passive income, and we could set that up properly in the right entity structure so we have the right entity owning that type of that part of the business. Then we can end up with passive income that when we combine it with our other investments, we could end up with absolutely no tax on that income.
Once again, a preferred income category there that I would like more and more of. Excellent, excellent. Okay, now actually, if you go back to this, you said one of the important parts of saving a lot of money in taxes is the kind of entity, and you said briefly that sole proprietorships are bad, generally speaking. What other kinds of entities are there? And what kinds do you sometimes employ as part of a strategy for some of your clients?
Okay, so basically, under the tax law, there are four types of entities, okay? And an individual sole proprietorship is not really an entity. We'll call it an entity. Sole proprietor, okay? We have partnerships. We have corporations. And we have trusts. Now, I won't get into trust much because we don't typically use trusts in business. They're used for things like estate planning and family planning. So I'm going to kind of an investment plan, and we'll kind of shy away from that. So the three types of primary entities are partnerships, sole proprietorships, and corporations from a tax standpoint. Now, the one thing I haven't mentioned is limited liability companies, or LLCs, and that's because from a tax standpoint, LLCs have no tax status. So an LLC is going to be taxed either as a sole proprietor, a partnership, or a corporation, depending largely on what we choose. A limited liability company is a type of an entity that is there solely for asset protection purposes. Okay, solely for asset protection purposes. It's a great type of entity. We have to recognize that we have to do something with that entity to determine how it's going to be taxed. So we have sole proprietorship. We've already determined that's not a good one. In the partnership area, we have two types of partnerships primarily. We have a general partnership. We just already talked about general partnerships. They're pretty much the only thing worse than a sole proprietorship. And we have limited partnerships. And limited partnerships means, what a limited partnership is there's one, at least one partner is a general partner. Okay, so they have unlimited liability, and they have they're going to be taxed on their ordinary income as self-employment tax. Okay, and then we have at least one partner who's a limited partner. A limited partner basically has no, pretty much no say in the business. They've contributed money or something, or you've gifted them a share. For example, you might have gifted a limited partnership interest to one of your children. Okay, there's a big hint there. You might gift a limited partnership interest to one of your children. And so limited partnerships are taxed differently than general partnership. And the limited partner is protected. They have asset protection. All they can lose, basically, if it's done right, all they can lose is their investment. So they can't lose. Somebody can't come sue normally a limited partner for something done in the partnership. The limited partners don't get sued, okay, personally. So that's the other kind of partnership. And by the way, partnerships can be very useful in an overall business structure. In fact, we even use limited liability companies taxed as general partnerships. Limited liability company, not a pure general partnership, just a limited liability company taxed as general partnership. We frequently use those in an entity structure. When we do that, it's not just, we don't have just one entity, though. We have other structures. Now, this sounds a little complicated because we have about 15, we don't have very much time to talk about this. When we sit down with a client, we talk about this in great detail and explain very simply, here's what happens and here's what you should do. Just a little side note before I get back into corporations. When you're sitting down with a tax advisor, or any advisor for that matter, whether it be a financial advisor or an attorney, always choose somebody who is willing to put their advice on the line. In other words, they'll tell you what the options are, and then they will tell you what they think your best option is. It kind of drives me crazy when I hear an attorney say, well, here are your options, and you choose, and because I can't choose for you. Well, I'm hiring an attorney to not only give me the options, but tell me what they would do.
Yeah.
Same with a tax advisor, same with any other type of advisor. You want somebody who will put their advice on the line. Okay, so getting back to the corporations. Okay, so we've talked about sole proprietorships, and we've talked about partnerships. The third kind is a corporation, and there's two types of corporations from a tax standpoint. There's a C corporation, which we think of as a regular corporation, and there's an S corporation. Now, the primary difference is a C corporation has its own rules and pays its own taxes, like IBM, Microsoft. These are C corporations, okay? And so there are specific rules that apply to a C corporation that don't apply to any other type of company. Now, that's another hint, because there are some really good rules that apply to C corporations, and we frequently use C corporations as part of our tax strategy, not solely, not just a C corporation. We frequently use them as part of our tax structure, our entity structure, our tax strategy. S corporations are quite different because S corporations The corporation doesn't pay any tax. The income is taxed to the shareholders. Okay? So you don't pay a tax at the corporate level. You only pay a tax at the shareholder level. Very similar to a partnership or sole proprietor. Okay? Where you're taxed, the individual is taxed, the company is not taxed. So those are your basic types of entities. And done right, you know, they can be simple. We can have one entity, maybe two entities sometimes is all. And I've seen entity structures like my own that have 20 or 30. Now, at that point, you know, there can be quite a bit of administration. So I would suggest don't let your tax advisor get you too complex, okay? Take it as simple as you can and still getting the maximum amount of benefits, both from an asset protection standpoint and from a tax standpoint. Is that helpful, Jennifer?
It is helpful. It's both helpful, and I know it's created more questions as well. And I see a flow chart here. Gina is, among other things, she's the queen of flow charting and saying, hey, here's how everything works together.
I love it.
As you were, I knew you would like that. As you were describing this, I'm thinking, okay, so depending on somebody's situation, their strategy, it's not just going to be one thing. So we know sole proprietorship's not good, but we might not just have an S-corp or a C-corp, or there might actually be a reason for an LLC. That might be over up here on the left, but I know it sort of depends on everybody's individual situation. Maybe, as an example, you and I were talking not too long ago, and you were telling me about a client of yours that took you to dinner, wanted to take you to dinner to get some tax advice, and I think you run into this all the time. And if I remember correctly, you kind of heard out the guy's situation, and you gave him a few strategies that saved him, I don't know, something like $25,000 over, hey, do this here, do that there, and it wasn't too complex. Do you remember that?
Oh, there are so many of those.
there's so many of those. Okay. So this
let me give you a simple example.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
Let me tell you about a client, and I have authority to give her name out, so I'm going to. Her name is Kim Butler. She's a life insurance agent in Texas, and I will do a little plug for her because she is the best life insurance agent I've ever run into. So we're happy to give you that information. Kim's been a client and a friend for years. And we were doing a call very similar to this one not too long ago. And we were talking about taxes to her clients. And she said, Tom, do you remember when we did my strategy? And I said, well, vaguely. She says, do you have any idea how much we saved? I said, nope. She said, we saved $70,000 a year doing my tax strategy. $70,000 a year. Now, Kim had a fairly complex situation. Probably cost her $20,000 to develop that strategy. I suspect there are people on this call who would gladly pay $20,000 to save $70,000 a year in taxes. Even better, of course, if we can make it a little cheaper than that. And for most people, it's much less money than that to sit down and create a tax strategy. The very first thing we did with Kim, this one I do remember, is I was looking at her entity structure, and I was going, I'm about 3 minutes into our discussion, into looking at her, at what she was doing. I said, there's one thing we could do that would save you $7,000 a year, and it will take 5 minutes to do it. And it's making an election. There was an election that we made on her tax return that saved her $7,000 a year for the rest of her business life. Now, elections are something that most people don't think about. Elections are something we do on a tax return, or we may do prior to the tax return. And when we make an election, for example, let's say we have an LLC and we elect to tax it as a corporation. That's an election. Okay, we have to actually fill out a form and make an election. What happens when you make that election? Well, it can be very beneficial to make that election. Now, here's another point back to your a question that you had for me earlier, Jennifer. And that is, when do I do my tax strategy?
Right.
When do I start planning? Well, let me give you the elections are a very important part of when you do that. There are elections that you have to make your first year in business. Okay, there are elections you have to make your first year in business, or at least that you have to make the first year you file that tax return for that business. So let's say you've been a sole proprietor and now you're going to be a corporation. Okay, you have a new taxpayer, the corporation, whether it's an S or a C, it's technically a new taxpayer, and you have elections that you need to make on that tax return. So you want to make sure that your tax preparer, tax advisor, actually makes the right elections. In fact, I was just looking at a court case this morning. Happened to be for real estate investors. Quite honestly, it could just as well apply to internet businesses, and actually would apply to internet businesses as well, where a taxpayer took a particular position on his first tax return that he was in business and did not make the proper election, and it cost him a tax deduction over a couple of years of, like $45,000. So he lost $45,000 of tax deductions because he didn't make an election. That's how important elections are, and that's why doing it the first year you're in business, or as early as possible when you're in business, is better. Not just because you're going to, of course, anytime, doing it now, even if you've been in business for 5 years, doing it now is certainly better than postponing, because the sooner you do it, the sooner you start saving. If you can do it in that first year, you've got a leg up on anybody else that's doing business, because you've got that much less in taxes that you're paying over your lifetime. So these elections are, they can be critical. That's of those 79 items that we do on a tax return, I'm sure there's probably 12 of them that are elections that we do on a regular basis in order to reduce taxes and reduce the chances of an audit.
And
so Kim's a pretty good example. I suspect, Jennifer, that there some people would be pretty happy with that 350% return on a $20,000 investment.
Well, sure, absolutely. And let me just point that out. So in that first year, you saved her, $70,000. But this is not $70,000 just the year you set up the tax strategy. She's now going to save that $70,000 year in and year out for the rest of the life of her business.
That's right. She only had to pay the $20,000 once.
Okay. So that's a good investment, 350%. Then each year you add it, then that doubles or triples or whatever that does. And that's a big part of how the wealthy get wealthy quickly, because $70,000, let's just take that example, $70,000 in 1 year, imagine if that was put into an investment elsewhere, and then each year thereafter, the wealth that's going to come from that is multiplied, as opposed to money that just went to taxes, $70,000 gone.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I ran some numbers once. I'm an accountant. I like to run numbers. And I ran some numbers once on for somebody who made a $20,000 investment. And I looked at them making that $20,000 investment and getting the tax benefits from that particular investment and then reinvesting those benefits versus not having those tax benefits. The difference was, over 7 years, the amount of their wealth would double. Not just the amount of the tax savings, the amount of their total wealth doubled, because they took taking advantage of the tax benefits and reinvesting that money. So it's not, like you say, Jennifer, it's not just a matter of having a little extra cash. It's
right.
A matter of what can you do with that money. Think about it this way. Okay, for all you internet marketers, let's say you had that $70,000 to go towards your pay-per-click campaign. Let's say you have that $70,000 to go to your Google ad campaign. Let's say you had that $70,000 to go to improved SEO. All of these things, we know, all these marketing techniques, they take money. And we know that they're proven that we get those returns, and the returns are much bigger than, say, a real estate investor. Real estate investing is so slow. It's not bad, it's just slow compared to internet marketing. And if we have that extra money to put back into our business, how much faster can we generate income? And the nice thing about tax savings is you get them immediately, because what happens, you stop paying, you reduce your estimated tax payments.
Right.
Now, if I could, Jennifer, I'd like to add one little note of caution for our internet marketers. What I see, the biggest single issue I see with internet marketers is not understanding what they need to do from a tax standpoint, particularly that first year they start making money. Because
right.
what happens is they make this money, they're not used to having this money, they don't know that they need to make estimated payments, they don't have their tax strategy down, and what happens come April 15th? They owe a huge amount of taxes
yep.
and have no money to pay for it.
You know, a lot of people who just went to debt. Well, Tom, we have only maybe 3 minutes left, and you've gone over a lot of things today. You've given a lot of great strategies and tips on how people can start creating this massive tax savings. But on the off chance that we didn't understand all of it or get all of it down, how can somebody further look into really understanding how they can specifically put these strategies into place, understand what deductions they can take, what credits they can take, how to properly structure themselves so they, too, can start saving $25,000 a year, $70,000 a year, whatever it is, and not get hit with a big tax bill come April.
And how can they get in touch with Provision Wealth, too?
All right, so here's what you can do. Our website is www.provisionwealth.com. You can contact us via email at charliesamuel@provisionwealth.com, or you can call us at toll-free at 866-467-5809, 866-467-5809. On our website, we have an area called Wealth Strategy U. And in Wealth Strategy U, we have literally hundreds of articles that I've written about different areas of taxes and ways to save taxes, and that is totally free. It's a totally free resource, and I always am, when I write these articles, I'm constantly looking at how to reduce taxes. So every article is about some area of tax reduction, and there are literally hundreds of them on the website. We also talk about wealth strategies on the website and business strategies on the website. So there's lots of free information, www.provision, P-R-O-V-I-S-I-O-N, and don't forget to put wealth on the end. Otherwise, you'll go to a nonprofit organization. Go to provisionwealth.com or send us an email at cs@provisionwealth.com. I'm all about giving more information. We do have a great seminar coming up. It is a teleconference. It is coming up starting on June 9th. It's 5 weeks to teach how to think about taxes and permanently reduce your taxes. Contact us. Either go to our website or contact us at 866-467-5809, and we can get you signed up for that seminar.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, for being here. Really appreciate it. I think we've got just another minute or so, Jennifer.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Okay, so I just want to reiterate. Now, Tom, you know I've been to your site, and I read a ton of your articles. And for those listening, absolutely, I've gotten those tips and implemented them on my own as well as, you know, from Tom directly. I have seen you, again, create these strategies for lots of people. So if you don't know what you're doing tax-wise, go to provisionwealth.com. Tom, this is the seminar coming up. It's a teleseminar. Is that correct? So people can.
That's correct, and it will
home.
Be recorded. So when you sign up, if you miss a meeting, that's okay. You can listen to it online.
And the quick purpose of this teleseminar is what? The overall.
Five secrets to massively reducing your taxes. The types of things I talked about today, I'm going to get into a lot more detail, in that teleseminar series. We're going to talk about the rules that the IRS won't tell you. We all know that while the tax law may be there for our benefit, the IRS doesn't want us to know. So we're going to tell you how to think about the IRS rules, how to think about saving taxes, and we're going to go through things like how to reduce your audit risk and how to do your tax strategy, how to improve your entity structure, and then look at those different types of permanent tax savings. So the things that we kind of previewed today, we're going to go into in detail during that seminar. It will be a one-of-a-kind seminar. It's never been done before. It's how to think about taxes differently to permanently reduce them for the rest of your life.
Excellent.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here, Tom. For those of you listening, if you're trying to get to the IM University's forum, we've been hacked. Our servers have been hacked. We are working on that right now. Hopefully we'll get that fixed sometime today. And join us again next week, Tuesday at noon Eastern, for another great episode of Relationship Marketing 101. Thanks so much, Jennifer and Tom, for being with us today. This was an awesome show.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.